If you take a wrong turn, you'd better hope that deranged, mutated hillbillies are what you end up running into. Because these stories will show you there might be some rather unsettling things out there for those who stray too far from the path. Welcome back to Unexplained Encounters. I'm your host, Darkness Prevails, here to tell you stories that are allegedly true and about the unknown. Today's episode features a collection of allegedly true wrong turn horror stories. If you have a scary story of the unexplained, send it to me at darkstories.org so I can narrate it on the show. And leave Unexplained Encounters a follow and review on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Now, let's begin. The Legend of the Woodsman, from Starve Osa. The last normal thing Hollis ever said to me was a complaint about his breakfast burrito. Too much cilantro, not enough egg. We were sitting on the tailgate of his Subaru at the Black Mountain Campground trailhead. It was October. He was picking green bits out of his tortilla like they personally offended him. "Next time we stop at that place, remind me to order something else," he said. There wouldn't be a next time. But I didn't know that yet. I'd met Hollis at a wilderness first aid course in Boone. He'd passed out during the compound fracture demonstration. Just went white and tipped over like a felled tree. When he came to, first thing he said was, "Did I miss the part about spurting blood?" The instructor wasn't amused, but I couldn't stop laughing. We grabbed a beer after class, found out we both hiked most weekends, started meeting up at trailheads. That was 4 years ago. Since then, we'd covered most of the decent trails within driving distance, built up that easy rhythm where you don't need to fill every silence. That morning, he'd been weird, though. Fidgety. He kept checking his phone, even though we both knew the signal up there was non-existent. When I'd picked him up at 5 a.m., he had a folder of printouts on his lap. Looked like some maps and forum posts. I saw some grainy photocopied pages, too, from what looked like old newspapers. "Research," was all he'd said when I asked. Now, sitting at the trailhead, he finally showed me what he'd been planning. "Look, there's another trail. Branches off about 2 miles up from the Mount Mitchell Trail. Some sort of old road." He spread one of his printouts on the tailgate, weighted down with his water bottle. "I found it on this archived hiking forum. Supposedly connects over to Buncombe Horse Range. Less traffic." I looked at the hand-drawn map. Looked kinda sketchy to me, honestly. The kind of thing someone drew from memory 20 years ago. But Hollis was already lacing up his boots. That determined look on his face I recognized from when he decided we were going to do the whole Art Loeb Trail in one day during a heat wave. The branch off the trail was barely visible. Just a gap in the rhododendron where decades of feet had worn the earth bare. An old blaze mark scarred a pine trunk, more like a wound than a trail marker. The path immediately shot upward at an angle that made my knees begin to ache just looking at it. "You sure this is the one?" I asked. Hollis was already pushing through the roadie. "Where's your sense of adventure, man?" The trail was a bastard. Steep and overgrown, the kind of route that made you wonder if you were actually on a trail or just bushwhacking up the mountain. With what little spots of reception I had, my GPS app showed we'd climbed over 1,200 feet in less than 2 miles. The forest changed as we climbed, newer growth giving way to ancient trees and gnarled things that had never seen a chainsaw. We stopped for water in a small clearing, and then Hollis decided to come clean. "So, there's actually a story about this trail." I groaned. "Now it comes out. What is it?" "Well, hear me out. I've been working on a book." "Still?" "About legends in the Appalachian Mountains. This trail has a genuine legend. A guy named Jeremiah Cotter lived up here after a logging accident took his arm. Went hermit. Started to threaten hikers who came too close to his territory." "What kind of threatening?" Hollis pulled out one of his photocopies. A forum post. Must have been from the early 90s if I had to guess. Something about claims of a hiker being found decapitated. Though if it was from a forum, who knows how true that was. The rest of it was too faded to read beyond that. So you're telling me you brought me on a trail where people possibly get their heads cut off? That was decades ago. The guy's definitely dead now, if he was even real. But the story, his eyes lit up the way they did when he talked about his writing. Local forums say people still hear chopping sounds up here, see axe marks in fresh trees. Some people think it's a ghost. Some think he had a son who took over the family business of, you know, murdering trespassers. Jesus, Hollis. It's just folklore. These mountains are full of stories like this. Keeps the tourists on the main trails. He folded up his papers. Besides, wouldn't make much of a book if I didn't check out the actual locations, would it? We made camp just before dark at a semi-flat spot near a spring. Barely room for two tents, honestly, but it would work. The view through the trees showed ridges fading into blue distance. The kind of vista that reminded you why you dealt with the climbs and the bugs and the freeze-dried food. Hollis would not shut up about Jeremiah Cotter over dinner. How the logging accident had taken his arm, but made the remaining one freakishly strong. How he'd built a cabin somewhere up here, lived off trapped game and spring water. How hikers who ventured too far off trail would find warnings. Dead animals hanging from branches. Fresh axe blazes appearing overnight next to their tents. And then the killing started, he said, passing me his flask of bourbon. Always the same. Single axe blow, clean decapitation. They closed most of these side trails in the 80s. But not this one. This one doesn't officially exist. I didn't sleep well. Not because I believed his ghost story, but something about these woods felt wrong anyway. They were way too quiet. Even the usual night sounds seemed muted. But then, the chopping woke me up at 3 a.m. A chop, 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 maybe a half mile upslope. With the way the woods had been so quiet, it carried so well. I lay there listening, trying to figure out what it was. A late night camper cutting some wood, someone who needed to fuel their fire. But this late, at 3 a.m.? The sound stopped. But then it started again, and would stop again. I unzipped my tent, stepped out into the cold. The fire had gone out by then. Hollis's tent was dark. The chopping resumed, that same rhythm. I grabbed my headlamp, but I did not turn it on. There was a rock ledge about 50 yards from camp. Don't ask me why I needed to look. Something about that sound just made me so curious. I picked my way through the dark, placing each foot carefully to avoid snapping twigs. The ledge overlooked a small clearing I hadn't noticed during the day. Moonlight revealed a figure in the center, working at a large oak with an axe. But I noticed it quickly. He was missing an arm. And the other arm was very large, much more muscular than an average man. Between sets of chops, it would stop, turn, and look directly at where I lay watching. I couldn't see a face, but I felt its attention like cold fingers on my spine. We stayed frozen like that, me on my belly at the cliff edge, it standing in the clearing. Then it returned to its work, chop, chop, chop. I crawled backwards until I hit trees, then crouch-walked to camp. I spent the rest of the night in my tent, listening to that chopping until dawn. When Hollis woke up, he was whistling. He made some instant coffee like nothing had happened. I told him we were leaving. Whoa, what's wrong? I explained what I'd seen. He listened without his usual interruptions, face growing serious. Okay, he said finally. If you're spooked, we can go. That's the rule. We'd established that rule early. If either of us felt unsafe, we left immediately, no questions asked, no pressure, no mockery. It had saved us from lightning on Craggy Pinnacle and sketchy river crossings on the Linville Gorge Trail. Now it would save us from whatever I'd seen in that clearing. We broke camp fast. We're on the trail by 7 a.m. Morning mist rose up from the valleys. Birds called. In daylight, my fear seemed almost stupid. Almost. A mile down, Hollis stepped off the trail. Ugh, too much coffee. Give me a minute. He pushed through a thicket of mountain laurel. I waited, checking my dead phone out of habit, stretching my calves. 5 minutes passed. 10, then 15. Hollis? There was no answer. I walked to where he'd entered the bushes, could see broken branches where he'd passed. Not funny, man. 20 minutes. I was about to go in after him when I heard crashing. Hollis burst out, face white as paper, left hand clamped on his right bicep. There was blood seeping between his fingers. Run! Go! He gasped. We ran, sliding and stumbling down the trail. There was no sound of a follower, no pursuit, but Hollis kept checking over his shoulder with real terror in his eyes. We hit the main trail, kept running until we reached the parking lot. His arm was bad. He had a deep gash from bicep to elbow. I wrapped it with gauze from my first aid kit and got him in the car. Not until we were doing 90 toward the nearest hospital did he tell me what happened. I was squatting down, heard footsteps, I thought it was you. Then I saw this axe swing right where my neck would have been if I'd been standing. Buried itself halfway through the tree. I rolled and tried to get up and it came again, and that's what caught my arm. You saw him? Not really. Nothing more than a glimpse. Big, bearded, empty sleeve pinned up to the left. He shuddered. That axe was old, man. Rusty. And the strength in that one arm. He almost cleaved through that tree in one swipe. At the hospital, he got 23 stitches. He told them he'd fallen on old farm equipment. Hollis never finished his book. We still do our hikes, though. Sticking to crowded trails now. The ones with families and dogs and maintained bridges. Never venturing off the path. Neither of us want to get swung at again.
Persil sorgt schon seit 1907 für tiefenreine Wäsche, auch bei den Johnsons, oder Anna?
Das stimmt. Sogar meine Oma hat schon mit Persil gewaschen.
Und als Dankeschön für über 100 Jahre Vertrauen gibt's jetzt bis zu 15 Euro Rabatt auf unser Bestes.
Das mit der roten Schleife.
Genau, made in Germany. Mehr Infos auf unserbestes.persil.de.
Wenn es tiefenrein ist, ist es Persil.
Hey there. Darkness Prevails here, founder of EerieCast, my little network of scary shows. I appreciate you listening to our scary content. But did you know you can support us? Get ad-free feeds of your favorite shows, get a 20% discount code to the EerieCast store, and unlock access to members-only audiobooks all at the same time. Just go to EerieCast.com/plus and become a member today. It's cheap and really helps us out. That's EerieCast.com/plus. Thank you. Camping trip wrongness. From none of us. This happened about 3 years ago, summer of 2021. I've told maybe two people about it since then, and even they looked at me like I was making it up. But I know we saw something out there, and I know we're lucky to be alive. There were five of us. Me, my roommate Nico, his girlfriend Bethany, and two guys from our D&D group, Jerome and Kai. We'd been planning this camping trip for a while, mainly because Jerome kept going on about this great spot, which his uncle showed him years back, near the Gila National Forest in New Mexico. Secluded, he said, with beautiful views. No crowds either. The way he described it, you'd think it was paradise. The drive from Phoenix should have taken about 4 hours. We left Friday afternoon in Nico's beat-up Suburban. The thing was huge, perfect for all of our gear. I remember we were all pumped, windows down, and music blasting. Bethany had made this massive playlist of road trip songs, and Kai brought enough snacks to feed a small army. Everything felt right. The first couple of hours were fine. We stopped in Globe for gas, grabbed some last-minute supplies. Jerome was navigating with some hand-drawn map his uncle gave him, swearing it was better than GPS. "Technology tends to fail out here," he kept saying. "Trust me, it's old school, but it works." That's where we made our first mistake. We should have stuck to the main roads. Around sunset, Jerome had us turn off Highway 60 onto the dirt road, claiming it was a shortcut. The road was decent at first, wide and relatively smooth, but after about 20 minutes it got narrower and rougher. The Suburban was handling it fine, but I could tell Nico was getting nervous by how tight his grip was on the steering wheel. "You sure about this?" Bethany asked, leaning forward from the back seat. Jerome squinted at his map. Yeah, we're good. Should hit another paved road in like, 10 miles. Well, we never found that paved road. Instead, the dirt road just kept branching. Every time we hit a fork, Jerome would study his map, mumble something, and then point us one way or the other. The sun was completely down now, and outside the headlights, it was that kind of dark you only get away from the city. No moon that night either. After another hour of this, Nico finally pulled over. "Dude, we're lost." Jerome got defensive, kept insisting we were on track. But when Kai pulled out his phone to check the GPS, we had no signal. Not even one bar. The little blue dot on the map just spun in circles, searching. "Okay," I said, trying to keep everyone calm. "Let's think about this. We can either backtrack..." "For 2 hours?" Bethany cut in. "In the dark? On roads we barely remember?" She had a point. We'd taken so many turns, none of us were confident we could find our way back. Plus, the gas gauge was sitting at just under half a tank. We had to make wise decisions here on out. That's when Kai spotted something through the trees. There was a clearing maybe 50 yards off the road. "Hey, what about there? We could set up camp over there for the night. Figure this out in the morning when we can actually see everything." It wasn't ideal, but it made sense. We were all tired and frustrated. And honestly, the idea of trying to navigate back in the dark seemed worse than just camping wherever we were. The clearing was bigger than it looked from the road, probably the size of a baseball diamond. Flat ground, ring of pine trees all around. There was even an old fire pit in the center, with stones arranged in a circle with ancient ash inside. Other people had clearly camped here before. "See," Jerome said, trying to save face. "This is probably one of the spots my uncle mentioned. We're not that far off." Nobody really believed him, but we were too tired at that point to argue. We set up camp pretty quick. Two tents, got a fire going, arranged our chairs around. The temperature had dropped fast once the sun went down, so the fire felt good. For a while, things were actually okay. We cooked hot dogs and passed around a bottle of whiskey Kai had brought. Then we told some dumb stories. The stars out there were truly incredible. It was the first time I could see the whole Milky Way stretching across the sky. I remember thinking maybe getting lost wasn't such a bad thing after all. It was probably around 11 p.m. when we heard the first sound. We were all laughing at some story Nico was telling about his coworker when this howl, I guess you'd call it, cut through the night. It wasn't like anything I've ever heard. I can't really compare it to something. It was long, starting low, and rose to this weird pitch that made my hair stand on end. And it sounded very, very close. We all went quiet. "What was that?" Bethany whispered. "Coyote," Jerome said quickly. "I think some elks can sound like that. They make weird noises." Another howl answered the first one, from the opposite side of our camp. Same strange pitch and same drawn-out note that seemed to go on too long. Then a third, from behind my tent. "That's not a freaking elk," Kai said. Nico stood up and grabbed his flashlight. He had one of those big mag lights that can double as a club if you needed to. He swept it around the edge of the clearing, but the beam only penetrated maybe 20 feet into the trees before the darkness swallowed it. "There's nothing out there," he said, but he sounded nervous. Then the smell hit us, all of us at once, a thick and musky stench, like wet and dead dog at the same time. Bethany covered her nose with her shirt, and my stomach was doing flips. "Something died out here," Jerome muttered. But that wasn't quite right either. Dead things smell bad, yeah, but this wasn't the same. This smelled alive somehow, alive and wrong. The howling stopped, but somehow the silence was worse. We all kept looking at the tree line, waiting to see something. The fire felt so small suddenly, like the dark was pressing in closer. "Maybe we should sleep in the car," Bethany suggested. "Come on," Nico said, trying to sound brave for his girlfriend. "It's just animals. They're more scared of us than we are of them." I wanted to believe him. All of us did. So we stayed by the fire for a while, though nobody was laughing anymore. Every little sound made us jump. Around midnight, we decided to call it. Jerome and Kai took one tent, Nico and Bethany the other. I had my own small one-person tent, which I was now regretting. By then, I was craving the safety in numbers and all that. I remember lying in my sleeping bag, staring at the thin fabric over me, listening. The fire was barely aglow now. I could barely see anything through my tent wall. Every couple of minutes, I'd hear something moving around outside. Barely audible footsteps, I thought, circling. I hoped it was a deer, something harmless looking for food. We'd been careful to hang all our food in a tree away from camp, though, so whatever it was should move on soon. Then I heard Kai whisper from the next tent. "You guys hear that? Shut up and go to sleep," Jerome hissed back. But I could hear it too, this heavy breathing just outside the tents. And the smell was back, much stronger now. My hand found the knife I kept in my sleeping bag. Just a folding pocket knife, nothing serious. But it made me feel better. I lay there, barely breathing myself. Waiting for, I don't know. And then something pressed against the side of my tent. I could see the indent in the fabric, about 3 feet up from the ground. Like a hand pressing in, but wrong. The number of fingers wasn't right. There were four. The thumb wasn't visible. It dragged along the nylon. Was it testing it? I wanted to scream, but it felt like my throat locked up. The pressure moved around to the front of my tent where the zipper was. I could barely make out a shadow through the fabric. Tall and not entirely human-shaped. The zipper began to move. Just an inch, so slow I almost thought I was imagining it. But no, it was definitely opening, tooth by tooth. That's when Nico started to yell, cursing and screaming at something to get away, get away. His flashlight beam went crazy inside their tent. I saw shadows whipping around. Bethany screamed then too. The thing at my zipper vanished, and I heard rapid footsteps heading over toward their tent. I finally found my voice and called, "Nico!" I fumbled for my own flashlight, unzipped my tent. My hands were shaking so bad it took me 3 tries, and I stumbled out. Nico had burst out of his tent too, maglite in one hand, camping hatchet in the other. His face was white and his eyes were huge.
There was something there, looking in at us. Its face.
Bethany crawled out behind him, sobbing. Jerome and Kai emerged from their tent, both holding knives.
"What do you mean?" Jerome asked. "What did you see exactly?"
Nico shook his head, still sweeping the trees with the flashlight.
I don't know. It looked like a person, but look, I just don't think it was human. Whoever they were real tall."
We formed a tight circle around the fire, using whatever we had for weapons. That smell was everywhere now, so thick I could taste it. And we could hear multiple somethings moving in the trees around us. That weird breathing sound, too, from every direction.
We need to go back to the car now, I said.
It was parked about 30 feet away, right at the edge of the clearing. Might as well have been miles, though. All together, Nico said. Stay tight. Move slow. We started shuffling toward the Suburban. I swear I saw these crouching shadows. I hoped they were tree trunks. We made it maybe halfway when Kai's light caught something.
Oh, Christ, he said.
About 10 feet to our right, just at the edge of the clearing stood... It's difficult to say. It looked like a man, but wrong. It was covered in fur or hair, but almost in a mangy sort of way. And its face looked like a man's facial skin, peeled and stretched over a dog's skull. And it didn't fit. Not at all. I could see fleshy bits poking out that shouldn't have been. Spots of pink and red, viscera that should not have been exposed. And I swear the way it looked, it was smiling. We ran then, screw staying together, screw moving slow. We sprinted for the Suburban in our own directions. I heard Bethany scream, and the rest of us were shouting. Behind us, all around us, I heard them moving, and they were fast. They ran on all fours, whatever they were. Nico got to the driver door first and screamed, "Get in! Get in!" I yanked open the back door, shoving Bethany inside, and I dove in after. Kai and Jerome piled in the other side. Nico got the engine started just as something slammed into the side of the vehicle. The whole Suburban rocked. Through the window, I saw one of those things pressing its awful face against the glass. Smudgy, thick trails were left wherever that pink, fleshy skin was exposed. Its breath fogged up the window as it examined us with reflecting eyes. Jerome was screaming for Nico to drive. Finally, Nico threw it in reverse, tires spinning in the dirt. The thing at the window held on for a moment, and I was scared it would stay on. But then it let go, and it began to run alongside us. In the rearview mirror, lit red by our taillights, I saw at least four of them standing in the clearing, just watching us go. But here's the thing. We couldn't go very fast. The dirt road was too rough and too narrow, and they were following us. I could see them in the shadows between the trees, keeping pace easily. Sometimes on two legs, other times on four. Looks like they're trying to hurt us, Kai whispered. Like wolves. They're keeping us on the road. He was right. Every time Nico tried to speed up, one would dart in front of us, forcing him to brake. They wanted us to follow the road. But why? We found out a few minutes later. The road just ended. Dead stop at this wall of trees. No way forward. No room to turn around without doing like a 20-point turn. Reverse, I said. Just back up until... And then they stepped out onto the road behind us. All of them. I counted six, maybe seven. Hard to tell in the backup lights and in that panic. They stood there in a line, blocking our escape. One of them, the tallest of them, started to walk towards us. Not running, but walking. Bethany was hyperventilating and Jerome was muttering prayers I didn't know he knew. Kai was staring, hands pressed against the window. The tall one came right up to Nico's window, tapped on it with one long finger. The nail or claw, whatever it was, made this little ticking sound on the glass. Then it smiled again, really wide. I swear that thing had teeth going down all the way to its throat. That's when Nico moved so fast, I barely saw it. He threw the Suburban in reverse and floored it. The thing at the window jumped back to avoid being hit. Another one that had jumped on the hood tumbled off. We slammed into some of them behind us. I felt the impact, heard screaming. Theirs or ours, I couldn't tell. Nico kept his foot on the gas, engine roaring, tires spinning. We were pushing them back. Turn around! There's room now! I yelled. Nico cranked the wheel, still in reverse. We lurched sideways, front end swinging around. One of those things grabbed onto the bumper, got dragged along. Then we were facing back the way we'd come, just as that thing let go, and Nico shifted to drive, flooring it again. They came after us, of course, running alongside, jumping over the car, slamming into the sides. The windshield cracked as one landed on it, but Nico didn't stop and he didn't slow down. I don't know how we made it through that gauntlet. Pure luck, maybe, or maybe they let us go. Maybe it was more fun to chase than to catch. We drove for hours, taking random turns, no idea where we were going, just away. The sun came up eventually, and we found ourselves on a paved road, and not long after that, a highway. Then a gas station where we sat in the parking lot, all of us crying or shaking, trying to process this. We just went home, never did report it. The funny part is, we actually went and found Jerome's uncle's campsite several weeks later, using real maps and actual GPS. It was as beautiful as he said, but we couldn't bring ourselves to stay more than one night, and we never went back. I still have nightmares about those things, about what would have happened if we'd been slower, if the car had broken down, or if Nico had never gotten the courage to reverse. They would have pried us out of that van like human sardines. The Man in the Tree, from Lena. I'm a registered nurse. That means I've seen trauma, death, and things that would make most people lose their lunch. But nothing in the emergency room prepared me for what I found on that highway. A few years ago, I was driving back from my sister's place in Tillamook, taking the inland route through the Coast Range. It's a longer drive back to Portland, but I prefer it to 101. Less traffic, prettier scenery. I'd driven this road dozens of times before. The rain had been coming down for almost 3 days straight. Not unusual for Oregon in the spring, but this was heavy even for us. This was flood weather. It turns streams into rivers, and rivers into chaos. I was about 40 minutes into the mountains when I hit this washout. The road just disappeared into brown water. Not just a puddle or a flooded dip, but a legitimate river flowing across the asphalt where the road used to be. The water was moving fast, carrying branches and debris. I stopped about 20 feet back and turned on my hazard lights, trying to guess the depth of the water. My Accord sits pretty low. Even 6 inches of fast-moving water can sweep a car off the road, I've heard, and this looked deeper than that. No way to tell for sure, though. The water was just too murky with runoff. I sat there for a few minutes. I weighed my options patiently. There was no traffic behind me at all. Turn around and add 2 hours to my drive or risk going through? I was already running late for my shift, but drowning my car and possibly myself would make me a lot later. And then I remembered the forestry road I passed about a mile back. I'd seen it plenty of times. It's this gravel road cutting east into the trees. I never knew where it went, but I figured it had to connect back to the highway at some point, somewhere past the washout. Those logging roads usually form a network. And my position couldn't get much worse, right? So I reversed, found the turnoff. There was a sign marking the number, indicating a National Forest Road. That seemed promising. Federal roads usually go somewhere, right? The first mile was fine. Gravel, but well-maintained, and was wide enough for two vehicles to pass. I felt pretty good about my decision. My phone showed one bar of signal. Not great, but better than none. Then the road narrowed. The gravel became sparse, more dirt than rock, and the trees got close enough that they started to scrape my roof. I slowed down to maybe 15 miles per hour, dodging potholes that could swallow my whole tires. At mile two, I lost cell signal entirely. No service stared back at me from my screen. I almost turned around then, but I could see tire tracks in the mud ahead of me. Fresh ones. Someone else had come this way recently. Probably for the same reason. That made me feel a bit better. But it didn't last. I came around a blind curve at mile three and slammed on my brakes. There was this blue Toyota pickup wrapped around a Douglas fir tree about 30 feet ahead of me. The front end was crumpled like aluminum foil, and there was steam and smoke wisping from under the hood. My nurse brain kicked in immediately. I pulled over, grabbed my first aid kit from the trunk. I always keep a good one, and jogged toward the wreck. The driver's side door was hanging open. The windshield was spiderwebbed but intact. But there was no one in the cab. "Hello?" I called out. "Is anyone hurt?" There was silence, except for the rain pitter-pattering on leaves and the tapping sound from a cooling engine. I looked around, and I noticed the skid marks leading to the tree. Long ones. The driver had been on the brakes long before the impact. But why? The road was straight here. Then I saw blood. Not much, just a few drops on the driver's seat and a small trail leading away from the truck into the forest. Someone had walked away from this. Or maybe they'd been dragged. I followed the blood trail, calling out every few steps. It led about 20 yards into the trees before I found him. I need you to understand. I've seen bad trauma, motorcycle accidents, industrial injuries, you name it. But this, my stomach clenched and I had to breathe through my nose to keep from vomiting. He was hanging from a pine branch about 7 feet off the ground, by his hair. His head was tilted back, long dark hair wound around the branch multiple times, like someone had deliberately tied him there like that. And his arms were hung limp at his sides, but that wasn't the worst of it. His left leg was gone from just below the knee, not crushed, but gone. The stump was ragged, as if it had been torn. Blood dripped steadily onto the pine needles below, too much blood. He was wearing jeans, but the denim was shredded at the stump, mixed with tissue and bone fragments. He was breathing, though, shallow. That told me his airway was partially obstructed from the angle of his head. I stood frozen for maybe 3 seconds. I was trying to make sense of all this. How does someone end up hanging by their hair? How does a car accident result in that kind of amputation? And why was there so little blood at the crash site if he had lost a leg? Then my training kicked in. I needed to get him down, stop the bleeding, call for help. But I'm a 4'4" woman, and he was a good foot and a half above my reach. I looked around for something to stand on, a log or a rock maybe. Suddenly a branch snapped somewhere off to my left. Not a small one either, sounded thick. Something with serious weight had broke it. I froze again and listened. The forest had gone quiet, even the rain seemed muted. All I could hear was my patient's labored breathing and my own heartbeat. There was another snap. It was closer now. Then I heard more breathing, coming from something else out there. Something big and heavy. Every instinct I had was screaming at me to start moving back to my vehicle. But I didn't want to leave him. "Hello?" I called out. "Is there someone out there?" The breathing suddenly stopped. It had hurt me, and that shook me to my very core. I took a step back toward the road, then another. I took these slow and careful steps on my way back to my vehicle, trying to not make any sudden moves. It was like I was backing away from an aggressive dog, except I had no idea what I was backing away from. A tree creaked to my right. Not wind. There was no wind at the moment. It was the sound of something's weight shifting against wood. High up, too. Was it in the trees? I ran then. I hate to say that I left an injured and possibly dying man hanging there and ran like heck back to my car. And every bush and tree root along the way tried to trip me, but I managed to dodge them. Behind me, I could hear something moving through the forest, parallel to my path. Not running exactly, moving in a way that suggested it was observing me, if that makes sense. I burst out onto the road and practically dove into my Honda Accord. I locked the doors and fumbled for my keys, but I managed to drop them twice. When I got the engine to turn over, I threw it into reverse, and as I backed up, trying to find a spot wide enough to turn around, I saw something moving in my peripheral vision. Something big between the trees where I had just come from. Dark and massive, standing upright. I didn't get a clear look. I didn't want one. I focused instead on turning the car around and getting the heck out of there. I drove back the way I came, probably too fast for the conditions, but I didn't care too much. When I hit pavement, I finally got cell signal back. I pulled over and called 911. The dispatcher was calm and professional. She took the location and asked about my injuries. I told her about the man, the amputation, that he was suspended and needed immediate medical attention. But I didn't mention what I'd heard in the woods. I didn't know what to say. They wanted me to wait for the ambulance to lead them in. But I couldn't even do that. I was too scared. I instead gave them detailed directions, and I drove straight home. I called into work that day, told them the road was flooded and I was suddenly feeling sick. My first call in about 2 years. I spent the rest of the day in my apartment, with every single light on. For a week, I didn't hear anything new about the incident, but I did check the news obsessively. I called the non-emergency line twice, but they couldn't give me information, as I wasn't family. I started to wonder if I'd imagined everything, if the stress of work had finally broken something in my head. But then a coworker of mine called. She's an EMT, works out of the same hospital as me sometimes. We'd gone through orientation together years back, stayed friends. Hey, weird question. Were you the one who called in that trauma off that forest road last week? I admitted I was. Greg was on that call, she continued. Greg was her boyfriend, a paramedic. He said it was the strangest thing he'd ever seen. You want to get coffee? He told me some things you'd probably want to hear, so long as you promised not to tell anyone I told you. I agreed. We met up at a little place. She looked tired and didn't waste any time on small talk. They found him right where you said, hanging by his hair, his left leg gone below the knee. He was barely alive, lost way too much blood. They had to cut the whole branch to get him down. So, is he alive? Yeah, ICU. Still unconscious last I heard, but stable. I felt so relieved, followed immediately by guilt. What about his leg? She shook her head. They never found it. Greg said they searched the whole area. And the weird part was the wound. It wasn't consistent with trauma from a crash. The doctor said it looked more like, well, an animal attack. Bite marks on the bone and torn tissue, rather than cut or crushed. What? What kind of animal? That's just it. Nothing native to Oregon could do that. The bite radius was... She paused, like she was deciding how much to tell me. Greg said it was huge. Impossibly huge. And there were claw marks on the truck that didn't match the tree damage. We sat in silence for a moment. There's more, she said. The guy's hair, it wasn't just tangled into the branch. It had been tied, like braided around the wood. Someone hung him there on purpose. I never drove that route again. I found out later the Forest Service closed that road, and it's closed even to this day. The man survived, I heard. Woke up after 10 days with no memory of the crash or what happened after. Probably for the best. Ever see a floating white thing in the air? From It Speaks. This happened back in 1998, Thanksgiving week. I was in 7th grade back then. We had the whole week off from school, which was awesome. My parents both worked, so they were fine with me having friends sleep over, since it kept us out of trouble. There were four of us that night. Me, Brayden, Corey, and Topher. We were all in the same Boy Scout troop. Not the coolest kids in school by any means, but we got along. Brayden was the one with all the new video games since his dad worked at Best Buy and got discounts. That's why he was going on and on about his new PlayStation game he'd gotten. For the life of me, I don't remember what it was. We were in my basement playing GoldenEye on my N64, when Brayden started talking about it. I want to say maybe it was Silent Hill. I remember the discussion being about how creepy it was, and that the graphics at the time were incredible. Corey was skeptical because Brayden tended to exaggerate about everything, though. But Topher was interested. After about an hour of Brayden describing every detail about his new game, we were all pretty much convinced we needed to play it that night. The problem was, Brayden lived on the other side of the forest from me. Not far as the crow flies, maybe 4 miles, but there wasn't a direct road. You'd have to drive all the way around through town, which was more like 8 or 9 miles by then. My mom was at her sister's helping with Thanksgiving prep, and my dad was watching football upstairs. Neither of them would want to drive us over there just so we could play a video game. That's when Topher said we should hike it. We were Boy Scouts, after all. We'd done 5-mile hikes plenty of times. The woods between our neighborhoods weren't that thick, he said. Mostly pine trees and some shrubs. We could probably make it in an hour. Hour and a half at most. Now, looking back at this, it was obviously a very bad idea. But we were 12 and 13-year-old boys, Boy Scouts at that, and we thought we could do anything. The plan was simple. We would tell my dad that Brayden's mom was coming to pick us up. But we needed to meet her at the road, because she didn't know exactly where the house was. Then we would just walk through the woods to Brayden's house. His parents both worked nights at the hospital, so they wouldn't even be home when we got there. Perfect plan, at least to us. My dad barely looked up from the game when I told him that. He just said to be careful and take flashlights. We grabbed a couple from the garage, threw some snacks in our backpacks, and headed out around 6 p.m. It was pretty much almost dark by then, but we figured we'd be at Brayden's before it got really bad. The first part was easy. There was actually a trail behind my neighborhood that people used for walking dogs. We followed that for maybe 0.5 mile until it ended by a creek. Brayden said he knew his neighborhood was northeast from there, so we crossed the creek and kept going in what we thought was the right direction. After another 20 minutes, the woods got even thicker. The flashlights helped as much as they could, but we could only see about 10 feet ahead. Topher was in front with the map compass from his scout gear. Brayden was behind him, then me, and Corey was in the back. We were still joking around, talking about what order we'd take turns playing the game in. Typical kid stuff. But after an hour of walking, things weren't looking so familiar to Brayden. We should have hit the power line cut that ran behind his neighborhood by then. But there was no sign of it. The woods just kept going. Corey started to complain that we were lost. But Brayden insisted we just needed to go a little further. Then we realized we actually were lost. None of us recognized anything around us. The trees all looked the same in the dark. We'd been so confident about our direction that we hadn't really paid attention to landmarks on the way in. Topher's compass showed we were still heading northeast. But that didn't really mean much if we'd started from the wrong spot or veered off course. We decided to backtrack. The problem was figuring out which way we'd come from. We'd made a few turns around thick patches of briars and fallen trees. In the dark, it all looked different. We picked what we thought was the right direction and started to walk. After maybe 15 minutes of this, Corey stopped and asked if we saw that. Well, we asked what he was talking about. He pointed up through a gap in the trees. There was something white floating about 30 feet up above us, moving slowly through the air. It looked like a sheet or a piece of fabric, but it was moving against the wind. The trees were swaying one way, but this thing was drifting the opposite direction. Brayden said it looked like a plastic bag, something just caught in the wind. But it was too big for that, maybe 6 feet across and moved in a strange way. Like it was trying to move that way and not just accidentally being moved by the wind. It would drift for a bit, then stop, then change direction. and it seemed to be following us. When we started to walk again, it moved with us, staying roughly the same distance above and behind. We tried to ignore it and focus on finding our way out, but it was hard not to keep looking up at that white shape floating through the branches. Topher thought it might be some kind of weather balloon, but what would a weather balloon be doing that low? And why would it be following us? We'd been walking for another 10 minutes when Corey, who was still in the back, told us to stop and look up. The white thing wasn't floating anymore. It was about 15 feet above us, wrapped around a thick pine branch. But the way it was wrapped didn't look right. It wasn't tangled or caught. It looked like it was holding on. The material was bunched up where it gripped the branch. We all stood there staring at it, trying to figure out what we were looking at. The flashlights made it look almost translucent, like really thin fabric. But there was something solid in the middle of it, a darker shape that the white material was attached to. Then it moved. Not drifting this time, it unwrapped itself from the branch, and I'm telling you, it dove straight at us. It happened so fast, I barely had time to throw my arms up. The thing swooped past my head, and I felt something sharp rake past my cheek. Corey screamed. Never heard a sound like that come from him. Then we heard my dad shouting in the distance. He must have realized something was wrong when Brayden's mom never showed up. That was a hole in our plan. If my dad happened to be paying attention, he could see the road from where he was watching TV. Even if it was a ways away, he'd probably been watching, thankfully for us, and he had heard Corey scream. We ran towards his voice, crashing through bushes and briars, not caring about the scratches. The white thing pulled up and away, floating back above the tree line. But it followed us, keeping pace as we stumbled through the underbrush. We burst out of the woods onto the trail behind my neighborhood, where my dad was standing with a big flashlight. He was mad, asking what we thought we were doing, saying we could have gotten seriously hurt. But when he saw the blood on my cheek and how scared we already were, he switched to concerned parent mode. I then pointed up at the white thing, which was now maybe 50 feet up and drifting away. I asked him, "What is that?" And he looked up, squinting, and said it looked like a bird or maybe some balloon that got lost. But the way he said it, I could tell he wasn't entirely sure either. It was too far away now to see clearly, just a white shape against the dark sky. He marched us all back to the house, called everyone's parents. We got in trouble, obviously, grounded from sleepovers for a month. My mom cleaned up the scratch on my cheek, which wasn't deep, but left a permanent little mark on my cheek, the tiniest of scars. The story we landed on to explain the white sheet thing was what Brayden came up with. He said it was some sort of white owl that we really ticked off. But I remember what I felt when it swooped at us. I don't think that was a bird. The material was like cloth, but there was something solid inside of it, something with claws or sharp edges. And in all my days since then, I have never found a similar story. Maybe ghosts, sure. The stereotypical ghost sheet thing. But I don't know about that. But if my dad hadn't come calling, we could have been stuck out there all night with that thing swooping at us. What would have happened to us then? I guess I'd rather not know. Delivery Detour from Anon. I drove for FedEx Ground for 3 years before this happened. You get to know the roads pretty well doing 150 stops a day, but that Thursday in February, my regular truck was in the shop, and I got stuck with overflow from another route. I had about 20 packages for addresses I had never been to. The GPS took me down a farm road around 7:30 p.m., It was dark, no streetlights around, just farmland and distant houses, on occasion. I had one more delivery after this one, then I could get back to the terminal. The house I was looking for was supposedly on the right, but I'd passed where the GPS said it should be. I didn't see a mailbox or driveway, nothing. These rural routes were always tricky. Half the time the addresses were off by a quarter mile or more. I slowed down looking for any sign of a driveway I might have missed. And then I saw something in the field to my left. I thought it was a person out there. They were standing upright next to this big oak tree, about 40 yards from the road. But then I saw that this person was likely 7 feet tall at least, very thin, legs bent backward, with a long lower jaw and pointed ears. It was clawing at something in the tree, not climbing, just reaching up with these long arms, scratching or pulling at a branch about 10 feet up. I could see strips of bark falling down or debris or something. Its movements were frantic, aggressive. I stopped the truck. I'm not sure why, I should have kept driving. But when you see something that strange, your brain just needs a second to process it and second guess it. I left the headlights on and the thing turned its head towards me. That's when I saw those tufts of fur that dogs have on the sides of their face, and the animal-like eyeshine. People always say maybe I saw a bear. I know what bears look like. We get them in the neighborhood sometimes, getting into trash cans. This wasn't a bear. Bears can stand on hind legs, sure, but not constantly. And they sure as heck don't have arms that long. It dropped down from the tree and took a step toward the road. Not on all fours like you would expect, but upright on two legs, moving with this weird loping motion. So in response, I threw the truck in drive and got the heck out of there. I floored it past where the house should have been and marked the package as unable to locate address. Then I headed back to the terminal. I was honest. I told my supervisor I couldn't find the house. And I never delivered out there again. When they tried to give me that route a month later, I said I'd take the occurrence instead. Some roads you just don't go down twice. So, do you think limbs are like senses? You lose one and the other just gets insanely ripped? If that's the case, well, my right arm looks like I've never had a left arm in my life. I wonder why. Good night. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Unexplained Encounters. I'm your host, Darkness Prevails. You can find me on a new show where I take calls from people with paranormal problems, with my brother and Niall from Oni Plays. Just look for Night Watchers on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. It's an adult podcast, so viewer discretion is advised. Anyway, send me your scary stories of the unexplained at darkstories.org so I can narrate them on this show. And leave us a review or follow on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Thank you. Stay safe out there and stay creepy, because this world is a strange one.